thank you. I am really happy to be here tonight. And I'd like to thank Milton and the rest of the board members for inviting us down this weekend. It's our first time here to Monteagle, and we're really excited to be here. Everybody's just given us such a warm welcome, and it's obvious you guys have a really special conference going on here. We've already had a very, very full time. We got here last night and attended the gratitude meeting, which was a great way to start the weekend. And we drove into town this morning and went to the Smokehouse Trading Post and bought souvenirs for the kids and ate lunch. And then we drove, I really wanted to see a waterfall, and I had heard that there were some around here, so we drove to Foster Falls and hiked down to the falls and saw that, which was pretty spectacular, and stopped at the Dutch Bakery or something in Tracy City. Anyway, it was just a great day, and my husband, who you'll find out tomorrow night when he speaks, is kind of an intense person. And I was talking about, you know, how much fun we were having and everything that we were getting to do, and he got this sort of crazed gleam in his eye, and he said, yeah, I said, we're sucking the marrow out of Monteagle. So, as you can imagine, he, you know, it's good for us to get away. I knew one day last week that he had gone to see a massage therapist, and he came home from work that evening, and he was acting kind of strange and, you know, just not kind of weird. And I said, are you okay? I said, is there something wrong? And he said, I think I'm relaxed. I said, oh, that's it. That's what's okay. Now I understand. So it's good for us to come on a spiritual retreat weekend like this. Let's see. I am supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I will tell you that I'm a member of the Sykeston Serenity Group in Sykeston, Missouri. And by the grace of God, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September 15th, 1986. And I do have a sponsor. I grew up in Oklahoma and in a very kind of what I would consider average middle-class family. We lived in the suburbs in Oklahoma City. And I can't really ever remember a time in my life when alcohol wasn't a part of my life. My father drank, all my relatives drank. My parents grew up in Illinois, and he landed in Oklahoma because he is a geophysicist, and he went there to work for an oil company before I was born. But we would go back to Rock Island to visit his family, and it was always a big party. You know, the drinking was very much a part of the family reunions and everything, the holidays. And I was kind of a daddy's girl when I was little, and he would come home from work and sit in his easy chair. And at that time, he would come home and mix himself a cocktail, and he was drinking old fashions, which I don't know, I guess somebody still makes those, but it was kind of a sweet drink, and then put a cherry in it. And I'd kind of hang around there at his feet after he came home from work, and that old fashioned smelled so good. And, you know, every now and then he'd let me have a little sip, and if I was really good, he'd let me eat the cherry out of it. And I thought those were really good. And then as I got older, I was in grade school, and the liquor wasn't locked up or put away or anything at our house. It was down under one of the kitchen cabinets, easily accessible. And I kind of developed a taste at an early age for creme de menthe. And so I would come home from school, and I would get my favorite, you know, after-school snack, which was I'd fix myself a big bowl of vanilla ice cream, and then I'd get the creme de menthe out of the cupboard, and I'd, you know, splash a little bit on ice cream, and I'd stir it up real good until it was nice and creamy, and then I'd plop myself down on the floor in front of the television set and watch, you know, The Monkees, Bewitched, I Dream of Jeannie, all my favorite TV shows, and I'd eat my ice cream. And it wasn't until years later, of course, that I realized that I was having grasshoppers. And so I really couldn't tell you when my first drink was. I do know that when I was 11, I went to the lake with my little girlfriend from down the street, and she snuck a beer out of the cooler that they had, you know, down there at the cabin, and we took it down the lake and got in the water and floated out so nobody could see us on the inner tubes, and she got the beer out, and, you know, we were all giggly, and we split the beer, and she started acting kind of, you know, crazy and everything, and I thought, what is wrong with her? I didn't even get a buzz on, you know, so that kind of made me mad. But I have to say that I did early on have a very high tolerance, it seemed, for liquor, and, you know, kind of prided myself on being able to drink my dates under the table and that kind of thing. Another thing that was kind of funny is at one point my mom got a recipe for brandied fruit, and she had this big gallon jar of brandied fruit on top of our refrigerator. And one night we were sitting in the den watching TV or something, and we heard this horrible crash and, you know, big loud noise. And we went running into the kitchen, and the jar of brandied fruit had gotten so strong that it had exploded. And I used to eat that on top of my ice cream, too. So, anyway, my dad drank, as I think I mentioned, but I really remember him. I really had a very happy childhood. I remember him as a funny drunk. At that point in time, he would do stuff like come home from work and juggle raw eggs in the kitchen, which, of course, my mom really loved. And by the way, before I forget, I would like to especially welcome all of the members of Al-Anon family groups that are here tonight. Al-Anon has a very special place in my heart, and I owe it a huge debt of gratitude, which I'll get to later in my story, but I'm really glad that you guys are here. So he was kind of a funny drunk, and he would, you know, come home after he'd been out partying with his buddies, and he'd wake us up and tell us his own version of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, or, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk, and it was, you know, always, he'd throw in a little of this and a little of that, and, you know, I just adored my father, and so I mostly had a happy childhood, and my mother, I must say, was, and she was a teetotaler, although she also came from a line of alcoholics, and she was very careful to kind of protect us from the uglier side of his drinking. But as I got older, you know, I started drinking beer because that was the only thing that we could get in Oklahoma. And I absolutely hated beer. But I drank it because it was the only thing I could get. And I hated that I had to drink so much of it to get drunk. So it just made me feel so full and bloated, and ugh, I didn't like the way it tasted. But, you know, I forced myself to get it down. And I also experimented a little bit with drugs. You know, I started smoking pot around that age, but I really didn't like it too much because I got real paranoid. And, you know, the thing about alcohol is that it gave me the illusion of control. And I always felt like I was, you know, really perfectly in control when I was drinking. I, you know, had friends that did hard drugs and that, you know, and one minute they'd be okay, and then the next minute they'd be flat down on their face in the parking lot with a busted nose, and it just scared me too much. I really shied away from a lot of that. And my sister, who was 3 years older than I was, got me into a fair amount of trouble. I kind of started running around with her friends, and then when she went to college, I would go and spend the weekends at the dormitory and go out partying with them. And, you know, from a very early age, I always drank to get drunk. Was there another point to drinking? I always drank for the effect. And, you know, got through high school, and unfortunately, my father's drinking progressed, and things started to get worse at home. And by then, my brother and sister were both away at school, and I was the only child left, and kind of got you know, to see some of as that progressed and things got worse in my parents' marriage. But I graduated from high school, and I could not wait to shake the red dirt off my shoes and get out of Oklahoma. So where did I go? I went to Texas. and I went to college down there. And the great thing about Texas is that the drinking age is 18. So I had my last beer in Oklahoma, and I got down there, and I discovered vodka. And from then on, that was my drink of choice. And I loved it. I thought nobody could smell it on my breath. And, you know, obviously, I'm sure a lot of us thought that. And it worked so much faster than beer, and I didn't have to drink nearly as much, and I just loved it. I had always had this kind of, well, you know, as many people talk about in the program, you know, never quite feeling like you fit in, and I had this horrible fear of being mediocre, and I was chubby when I was growing up, and I was horribly self-conscious. And I was kind of bookish, and I remember there was a girl in school when I was in junior high named Sandra Mendenhall, and she was skinny, and she had this long, beautiful, straight blonde hair and blue eyes, and the little boys would just kind of flock around her, and I remember thinking, you know, if I could just look like Sandra Mendenhall, my life would be wonderful, if I could just be Sandra Mendenhall. So that was, you know, school at that time was pretty painful for me, and I think that was probably when I first started to experience depression, although I didn't really know what to call it. And that was something that continued throughout my drinking. So I went to college, and the party kind of ratcheted up a notch, and I joined a sorority, and you know, was still primarily a binge drinker, I would have to say. Did mostly binge drinking. I did manage to, you know, keep my grades up and graduate with honors. And I had studied filmmaking in college and decided that when I graduated, some of my friends were, you know, moving to Los Angeles to try to work in the film industry. And even though I had like two good job offers in Dallas, I decided no, I wanted to go to LA. And when I look back on that, I'm kind of grateful that I had that experience, because I think it made me hit bottom faster. And so against my parents' wishes, a friend and I loaded up a U-Haul trailer and hooked it on the back of my Ford LTD. And he got in his car and I got in my car, and we headed out west to Los Angeles. We didn't have jobs, we didn't have any place to live. Gosh, it's great when you're young. I had absolutely no fear. And so we got out there and got jobs and got an apartment. And, you know, I was basically, I guess, kind of a naive girl from Oklahoma. And I really wanted to fit in. And I ended up working at this very large talent agency, William Morris Agency, as a assistant to a casting agent. And I would say at that time, you know, at some point during all that, I guess I crossed that invisible line that they talk about and started drinking pretty much every day. And, you know, started to experience more and more loss of control. And the people that I hung out with. I mean, nobody ever told me that I drank too much, because I only hung out with people that drank as much, if not more, than I did. I really didn't care to have friends that didn't drink. I mean, what's the fun in that? And so everybody that I ran around with drank. I never missed work. I went into work no matter how hungover I was. And I was really sort of into the new wave punk scene. This was back in the early 80s. And I remember at one point I had cut my hair real short, and I decided that I should dye it magenta purple. And it's funny, because people that know me now, my husband especially, says, you know, I just can't picture you with purple hair. But I was there. You know, I thought at one point I had an ulcer because I had all these horrible stomach problems. And, you know, I had to drink Maalox out of a bottle all the time. And, you know, never thinking that the drinking had anything to do with it. And I started kind of running with a crowd that was pretty wild, and I started going out with this guy who's had a friend that owned his own limousine service. And so we would go out partying in the limo and bar hopping, And I remember one night in particular, my date, Doug, I had asked him if he wanted to come over and eat dinner, and I'd fix him dinner at my apartment. I was kind of going through a health food phase at that time. And so I'd fixed like these yogurt granola parfaits and you know, this really healthy, you know, wheatgrass juice and stuff for us to eat. And I had a bottle of wild turkey that a date from the previous night had left at my house and decided, well, maybe just have some of that, you know, wild turkey before my date got there. So I started drinking before my date came. Then we went out in the limo and we went to a Chinese restaurant and I started drinking sake. And then we ended up at this big party out in West Hollywood, and they didn't have any vodka, so I just started drinking whatever they had, and I think I finished the evening drinking cold duck. So I got pretty sick, needless to say, and I remember, I always have these moments of clarity in the bathroom. I'm not sure what that's all about. I don't know if any of you can relate to this, but I was in the bathroom upstairs at this condo, and I hadn't exactly passed out, but I was laying on the floor, and my head was kind of close to the toilet, and my feet were up against the door because it was a small bathroom. And I was conscious, but I was paralyzed from the ears down, and I couldn't move. So I'm like, well, this is inconvenient because I want to get back to the party. And so I'm laying there, and people are coming up, you know, trying to get into the bathroom, knocking on the door, and I'm like, oh, I'm okay, I'll be out a little bit, you know. Finally, somehow, I managed to get up, crawl to a bedroom, and get up into the bed somehow. And I wasn't really a blackout drinker. I heard somebody talk about having brownouts, and I was like, yes, that's what happened to me, you know? So things would be sort of fuzzy to me, and there'd be chunks of things that I didn't really quite remember, but if somebody told me the next day what we had done, then I'd be like, oh, yeah, I remember that. So anyway, that was kind of how this evening was, and I remember laying in the bed, and at some point, some guy came up and tried to take advantage of me, and I guess I was conscious enough to fight him off or whatever, but there are so many times during my drinking where I put myself in situations where some really horrible things could have happened to me, and you know, by the grace of God, a lot of stuff didn't happen to me and didn't have anything to do with me. I think that was, I guess, my higher power looking out for me, even though I wasn't looking out for him. And, you know, I have to say that I think I was always looking for a spiritual experience. It's just that I was looking for it in the wrong place. I was looking for it in the bottom of a bottle. I didn't know that I had that hole inside of me that needed to be filled. And as a child, I can remember feeling really close to God and looking forward to going to church with my grandparents and being really excited about it. And then as I got older and I started drinking, I started to drift away from God. And it wasn't God that moved, it was me. So I think that I was looking for something spiritually, and I started to meet some people out in Los Angeles that seemed to pick up on that, and I'd always end up being friends with people that were, I don't know, into different kinds of intense spiritual things. Like I became friends with a woman who had recently become a Buddhist, and she kind of wanted to get me into that, and then I had become very good friends with a girl, and she invited me to go to church with her, and this was like a non-denominational church, and she started talking to me about God and her relationship with God, and I was really drawn to this girl. I mean, I liked her. She was a neat person. But, you know, she was never judgmental of me. She never told me that she thought I should stop drinking, just started talking to me about her relationship with God. And that was very attractive to me. You know, it's like our program's based on attraction, not promotion. And she didn't promote. You know, she just talked about her own experiences. And so I started going to church with her, and had some pretty strong spiritual experiences out there, and basically, you know, decided that I wanted God back in my life, that I needed God back in my life. And unfortunately, about that same time, I got fired from my job, which was kind of humiliating. It was the first job I'd ever been fired from. And I was living, at this time, by now, I was living by myself in an apartment. and really started drinking at home by myself. There wasn't anything social about it, and started getting really depressed again, suicidal. Started having all these kind of crazy thoughts, like that we were going to be in a nuclear holocaust, and you know, I probably didn't have much time left on Earth, and got real paranoid, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, I just thought I was going crazy. And I remember I'd have these really sick fantasies, you know, about me, you know, committing suicide and laying in my coffin, you know, and looking up and seeing my family and other people file by, you know, looking down at me and, you know, just consumed with self, basically. And I decided that, you know, I needed to move back to Oklahoma and be around my family because probably this nuclear holocaust was coming, and I probably, you know, I wanted to go be with my family the short time that I had left on Earth, and, you know, basically I just bottomed out, wanted to go home, but, you know, I had to kind of glitz it up a little bit. So I basically did a geographic, and I moved back to where my family lived in Oklahoma City. Now, at this time, my parents have separated, and, you know, their marriage has basically kind of fallen apart, and I decided, you know, well, I really need to clean up my act here, and, you know, I'm going to try to be, you know, a good Christian girl now, and I'm going to go to church, and I'm going to quit running the bars, and I need to, you know, so I remember the day I was living in a duplex there with an old friend from high school, and I remember the day that I decided, that's it, you know, and I poured all the booze down the kitchen drain. Well, that was great, and going to church was great, but the problem was I still didn't feel like I belonged. I still didn't feel like I fit in. You know, I thought, here I am, all these nice people, and if they knew what I was really like and what I, some of the things that I had done, they wouldn't want anything to do with me. And I kept accidentally getting drunk, you know. And I went back to music. I went to, back to school to study music because I had had some interest in singing off and on, and I decided I wanted to study vocal performance, so I went back to school, and this was like the period where I was trying to control my drinking, and, you know, I switched to wine only, and I always had this thing where I wouldn't drink before 10 in the morning because if it was 10 o'clock, then it was time for brunch, and then I could have screwdrivers and Bloody Marys. You know, these are some of the methods we have tried, and obviously none of them work. And then when I started singing in school, I was actually studying opera, I would just drink for medicinal purposes. You know, I got this special cough syrup from my doctor that was supposed to soothe my throat, so I'd sneak into the ladies' room and take a swig of the coughs. Oh, now that's better. I can go to my voice lesson now. And, you know, I thought I did have a lot of I nevers when I got here, but one of the ones that I thought I had was, well, at least I never drank out of a brown paper bag. And then I remembered the time that my friend at school had told me about blackberry brandy and how it was good for your throat. And I was asked to sing at someone's wedding. And, of course, I was absolutely terrified. I'd never sung at a wedding or anything like that before. So I took my car and I parked it at the furthest end of the parking lot away from the church as I could get it. And I had this bottle of blackberry brandy, this little pint of blackberry brandy in a brown paper bag, and I scooted over into the passenger seat and I got out and I crouched down so nobody could see me. I was drinking out of the brown paper bag. So, you know, keep coming back because you'll probably start to remember stuff that you thought you didn't do. So that was kind of when I did the medicinal drinking. My mother started really kind of to lose it, and my older sister and I decided that she needed to go to Al-Anon. And we knew that my father had a problem, and she said, well, I won't go unless you take me. She was terrified that she was going to see somebody that she knew at the Al-Anon meeting in this kind of small town that we lived in. So we took her. We said, come on, we'll take you. So we took her to the Al-Anon meeting, and it was above a dress shop in the little downtown area of the town that we lived in, and you opened the door, and you walked up 12 steps to get to the meeting room. And I remember my sister and I were back behind my mother, kind of pushing her up the steps, you know, like, come on, Mom, it's going to be okay, really. So we get up there, and we go to this Al-Anon newcomers meeting, and I'll never forget the woman that was chairing it. Her name was Jabina, and she and her husband Steve were very active in AA and Al-Anon, and she said, you know, just keep coming back, you know, come to at least 6 meetings before you decide whether or not this is for you. So we told my mom that we'd go to the 6 meetings with her, and I was just undone by what I found at this Al-Anon meeting, which was unconditional love. And I remember sitting in those meetings and crying, and I didn't even really know why or what was wrong. But my sister and I went for my mom, and we ended up staying for ourselves. And so I got involved in Al-Anon family groups before I was sober. And this was, like I said, back in the early 80s, and they had this clubhouse. And there was the AA met in one room, the Al-Anons met in another room, and the Alateen met in another room. And so it was great because you'd go there, you know, like on Wednesday night, and they'd have all the meetings going on at once. And I met this young lady through Al-Anon, and she also just happened to be a member of AA. And I asked her if she would be my sponsor. And we had absolutely nothing in common, but she seemed pretty happy, joyous, and free, and she had something that I wanted. She seemed like she worked a good program. So she started taking me through the steps out of the big book, and I started getting honest with her and talking to stuff that I had been through, and I'd say, well, and then that happened, but, oh, I was drunk when that happened, and, you know, and then this happened, but, yeah, and I was, and finally one day she said, Laura, she said, you might want to consider that you're in the wrong room. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, I think that you might have a problem with alcohol, too. And I said, oh, no, 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 that can't be right. I mean, so I know I have a drinking problem, but I'm not an alcoholic. And she said, well, I'll tell you what. She said, why don't you take this big book? And she said, you know, why don't you start reading it and think, just try to keep an open mind. And so I started reading the big book. And when I got to the chapter more about alcoholism, that was when it kind of nailed me. And I remember going to my first AA meeting with Cheryl, my sponsor, and it was mostly a bunch of older men. And I actually did have a guy come up to me and tell me that he spilled more booze on his tie than I drank. But I kept coming back, you know? I mean, it took me a while to really admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that my life was unmanageable. That was obvious. But it took me a while to really admit to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And everybody just said, keep coming back, you know. And so I started to work the steps. And I remember the night that I went to a meeting the first time that I said, hi, my name's Lauren, I'm an alcoholic. And I finally admitted it. And I remember leaving that meeting and going out, and they had these horrible, ugly, orange patent leather couches in the hallway. I think they'd gotten them from a bus station or something. And I remember laying down on the couch there. I was waiting for my mom and sister to get out of the Al-Anon meeting. I just had this huge sense of relief. You know, I'm not crazy. You know, I'm sick. I have a disease, and it's called alcoholism. And it was like suddenly all the pieces just kind of fit into place, and I knew what was wrong with me. And so I kept going to meetings there and working with Cheryl, and there was a really small town. At this time, I was living out in the country with my mom, and there was a really small town called Luther that was about 30 miles from our farm. And I'd heard that there was a good meeting in Luther, a big book study, so I decided I'd go check it out. So I get in my car one night, and I drive out to Luther, and of course it's dark by then, and this town, it's like a one-street town, basically. And I wasn't really exactly sure where the meeting was, so I parked my car, and I kind of got out, and I was looking around for somebody, and I saw this man walking down the sidewalk, and so I kind of screwed up my courage, and I went up to him, and I said, "Hi," and he goes, "Hi," and I said, "Are you by any chance a friend of Bill W's?" And he goes, Bill W. He goes, "You think?" "No, I don't know any Bill W." He goes, "But if you're looking for the AA meeting, it's right back here." So we walk back through this like dark alley that's like got broken bottles and rocks and dirt, you know, and there's these creaky stairs that go up the back of this building. I remember guys talking about, they figured that was where the cure was going to come in. And we got up there, and it was this very small big book study meeting, and it was mostly got, you know, a bunch of farmers and just, you know, really salt of the earth, wonderful people. And I started going to the Luther meeting, and I'm so grateful that I had that opportunity, because I really feel like I get a solid foundation in those meetings. You know, they stuck to the book, and they stuck to the steps and the traditions. And when I had about 9 months of sobriety, I followed my voice teacher to St. Louis. And I was pretty nervous about, you know, going someplace. I didn't even have a year yet. And I found a meeting, and I got a new sponsor, and at that point in time, I was sort of working on my eighth and ninth step. So I started working with this new sponsor, and I was still trying to make amends. And one of the first meetings I went to in St. Louis was this Saturday night meeting, and there was this really cute guy there with blonde hair, and he had about 3 months of sobriety, and I had 9 months. Well, anyway, you know the story, boy meets girl on AA campus, and we started, you know, I started giving him rides to meetings because he had lost his driver's license, and, you know, I was just trying to be a good person. And so one thing led to another, and about a year and a half after that, we got married. And we had this big AA wedding, and, you know, his sponsor came, and my sponsor came, and all these people from AA came, and we didn't serve any alcohol at the reception. It was just, you know, it was just wonderful. And not too long after that, I got pregnant, and we had our first son. And around that time, my husband decided that he really didn't like AA, and he started kind of got a resentment towards AA. I'm not really sure. I think it was that he had reached the ninth step, and he didn't want to make his financial amends or something like that. So he worked up this resentment towards AA and decided that he didn't want to go to meetings anymore. And I was fairly devastated because, you know, our whole relationship was kind of based on recovery. And I knew that, you know, I could go along with him and quit going to meetings, or I could stick with it for myself. And in spite of the fact that he didn't want anything to do with it anymore, I kept going to meetings, and I hung in there and hung with it. And you know, I got a day job and graduated from music school, and we had another child and bought a house. We had the two cars in the garage, you know, the American dream. And at some point after I had my second son, you know, I don't want to have to keep going to those meetings. You know, I mean, my life was very full, and I had other things that I needed to be doing. You know, I was a mother now, and I needed to be responsible. By the grace of God, neither of my sons has ever seen me with a drink in my hand, but I kind of lost sight of that and lost my gratitude for that, and so I convinced myself that it was okay to quit going to meetings. And this went on maybe for about, I don't know, close to a year, and I started getting pretty crazy and pretty dry. And my husband and I planned a trip to Hawaii, and I remember I started to fantasize about, well, if I go to Hawaii, I can have one of those big pineapple drinks with the umbrellas and the, you know, fruit sticking out of it, and it would be okay because nobody would know I'm an alcoholic. You know, I don't know anybody in Hawaii, and I could get away with it. And I knew that I was skating on pretty thin ice. And so somehow I went to Hawaii and managed not to pick up the pineapple drink or whatever it was. And when I got back, I told my husband that I needed to start going back to meetings. And so I went back to a meeting and found a new sponsor. And she said, well, And at this time, I had close to 10 years of sobriety. And she said, well, you need to go to newcomer meetings. And I said, ooh, are you sure I have to do that? And she said, yeah, you need to go to newcomer meetings. And so I did. And I sat around and cried a lot. And go to this meeting, this newcomer's meeting, and I did steps, the first three steps, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And slowly but surely, I got back involved in AA. And we found a home group. My husband would off and on decide that he wanted to go to meetings. And at this particular time, he decided he wanted to get back in AA. So we found this home group. And the only reason, really, that we chose this home group is because they had babysitting. And we had these two little kids. So fortunately, this group was involved in all three legacies. You know, and they were very involved in service. And they had me, you know, being a greeter and all this, and, you know, really started getting involved in the group. And I'd like to tell you that my marriage survived. It didn't. And I never thought that I would have to go through a divorce, and I certainly never thought that I would have to go through a divorce sober. It was one of the most painful things that I ever had to do. But thank God I had found this home group, because they just loved me through it. They really just carried me through it. And I kind of just threw myself into, you know, getting involved in this home group. And at the time, they needed a GSR, General Service or Group Service Representative, to go to the district meetings. And I didn't really know what that was, but I started asking questions. And I said, well, I think I can do that. So I got elected GSR, and I started going to district, and I started going to area. And there was this man at the area meetings, and he always wore a suit and tie, and he looked real nice, and he was serving as our delegate at that time. And so I really had a lot of respect for this man, and I'd kind of watch him. You know, I'd sit in the back of the room with the other GSRs, and he was up on the dais with the officers, and you know, I would kind of watch to see how he voted on things, because I really agreed with him on most issues, and so I'd kind of watch to see how he voted, and then that's how I would vote. And anyway, eventually I worked up the courage to introduce myself to this man, and it was Clayton V. from Sykeston, Missouri. And we became friends through the area, through service work, and kind of had this whirlwind courtship. I invited him to come up to St. Louis and speak at a service workshop, which he did, and one thing led to another, and about 4 months later, we were married. You know, we're not impulsive or anything. And so I had a wonderful job at that point in time, and I had these boys that were 5 and 8 years old, and Clayton said, well, you know, I'm really not in a position to relocate, you know, because of my business and my law practice. And I said, oh, you know, I would go off anywhere. And, you know, I said, oh, that's not really a problem. I said, you know, well, the boys and I will move down to Sykeston. And I was kind of in for some culture shock down there. It's a town of about 17,000 people, one meeting in town. So if you get a resentment or you decide you don't like the way they do things, there's not a lot of options. You just kind of have to work through it, which has actually been really good for me. How much more time do I have? I don't know what, maybe 10 or 15 minutes? 15 minutes, okay. But it's been a wonderful experience, and I've grown so much. You know, I think it's Clancy talks about being a great sprinter, but he's not a good distance runner. And that is so me. I mean, you know, I change things regularly in my life. You know, if the going got tough, then I was gone. And so the longest thing I've done in my life is stay sober, you know. And that is a miracle in and of itself to me, that I am still here and I'm still sober. I don't stick with things. I'm not a joiner. I'm not. So anyway, I continued in service work, and Clayton and I continued to be involved at the area, and I was elected as the public information chair and I served at the district and in the area, and then I was alternate chair and chair, and now I have the privilege of serving as the alternate delegate for the Eastern area of Missouri, and that's been a real honor for me. I want to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that Clayton and I have been through since we got married. And as I said, he's speaking tomorrow night, and I know that he's going to talk about his daughter, Amanda. So I'm not going to talk about that. But I am going to talk about our son, my son, Clayton's stepson, and some of the things that we've been through recently with him. Jacob has always been different and unique and a challenge. And I'm not sure when he started drinking and using drugs. It was long before I was aware of it. And I was sort of prided myself on the, you know, I'd been around AA and Al-Anon so much that I'd be able to spot this. And, you know, I used to have talks with him, you know, and I, you know, I drug those boys to meetings, and they'd been running around AA halls since they were little. And, you know, so he started getting into trouble. I guess it was about when he got into middle school and started having problems at school, you know, with his grades, and not anything real serious, but suspected that maybe he was drinking and maybe using a little bit. But I would find these signs, you know, evidence, and, you know, it's different when it's your kid. And I was in denial, and he would lie to me. I would, you know, confront him, and he would lie to me, and I would believe the lie, because the alternative, which was to face the truth, was unthinkable to me, and it was so painful. And so I convinced myself that he was telling me the truth and that everything was okay. And when he got to be about 15, things really, it just continued to get worse and spin out of control, and I'd gotten really crazy. And one weekend, Clayton had to go to New York City to visit his son, and I was there with the boys, and my younger son had a couple of his little friends over spending the night, and I remember going to bed and thinking, oh, you know, I'm so glad I know where the boys are, they're all here, they're all upstairs in bed, safe. I got a phone call about 2 in the morning, and it was a friend of Jacob's mother, and she said, do you know where Dustin is? Is he over there? And I said, no. And she said, well, are you sure he's not out with Jacob? And I said, yeah, I think Jacob's upstairs asleep, and you know, but let me go check, and I'll call you back. Well, I went out, I'm sure, and none of the boys were there. And it turned out that Jacob, we had started setting the alarm on the house, and Jacob would figure out if he crawled out these windows that went out to the patio, it wouldn't set off the alarm, so he had snuck out, taken his 12-year-old brother and their friends out with him, and were out running the street somewhere. So I finally found them and got them all back to the house, and I was livid with Jacob, and he was sitting down in one of the chairs upstairs, and I had heard a speaker at the Five Corners Convention just not very, maybe a few months before that, and she talked about having a daughter that was a drug addict and how hard it was to let go of her daughter, and it reached a point where they actually kicked her daughter out. And I remember thinking, wow, that would be so hard. I don't know if I could do that. And I guess this night when I found Jacob, I hit some kind of a bottom. And I looked at him, and I said, and this way, I don't have the strength to say this myself, so I think this was a God thing. I said, Jacob, I said, if you go back out tonight, I said, don't come back. And I turned around, I didn't even wait for him to say anything, I turned around and I went down the stairs, and I went to bed. And I was laying there, and I could hear him up in his bedroom. I could hear dresser drawers open and him walking around, and I thought, well, he's either getting ready to go to bed or he's going to leave. But somehow, I just kind of had, I prayed, and I turned him over to God, placed him in God's hands, and I somehow went to sleep. And I got up the next morning, and Jacob was gone. and we didn't know where he was for a couple of days. And we finally found him. He had been staying with a friend, and a few days went by, and the next Sunday was Mother's Day. And he called me, and he said, Mom, I really want to come home. And I said, well, Jacob, I said, it would be great to see you, and I'd be happy to talk to you if you'd like to come and visit. So he came over to wish me happy Mother's Day, and we started talking, and I said, I can't go back to the way things were. Just can't do it. And I said, some things are either going to change or you can't come back. And Clayton and I had been checking on some programs for adolescents in the meantime, and I mentioned this program up in St. Louis. It's sort of an unorthodox treatment program for adolescents. And he said, I think I need some help. And I wanted it to be his decision. I wanted him to go voluntarily. So we made some phone calls, and we took him up there, and unfortunately this meant that he had to move to St. Louis, which is about 2.5 hours away, and live with his father. And so, you know, he went to stay up there, and it was really painful for me. I kind of had to turn him over to these people in this program and say, here's my son. And a few months, that was like in May, and in July, I went on my first spiritual retreat at a place called the White House in St. Louis, and it was a silent retreat. And as we went through this stuff with Jacob, I sort of had this ability during a crisis to put my emotions in check so that I can do what needs to get done. And I think I had done that for the past couple of months. And I got to this silent retreat, and I was there by myself. And one night, the last night, and I didn't like the retreat director, and I wasn't really, you know, liking being there by myself, and so it was still kind of up in the air. I, you know, wasn't sure if it was really been a good experience or what. The last night I was there, I'm going to talk about a spiritual experience that I had. It was like a dam, it just burst. I was praying, and I started crying, and I was grieving losing my son, and I could not stop crying, and I just kept praying, and I was scared, and I was just falling apart. And it seems like this must have gone on for like, I don't know, an hour. And all of a sudden, it got really quiet, and I felt like I was flooded with the presence of God. And I had had spiritual experiences before, but it was just incredible. I kind of had like this out-of-body experience, and it was like I was still there, but I wasn't, you know? And I was trying to think how to put it into words because I wanted to talk about it. And last night at the gratitude meeting, Tony read something from the Big Book, and it just hit me, and I thought, that's it. That's exactly how I felt, and it's from the chapter, There is a Solution, on page 25. And it says, the great fact is just this, and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences, I can't see now because I don't have my glasses on, which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. And I knew that intellectually, and I knew it emotionally, but the feeling that night was so strong, the nearness of my Creator and the fact that He was living inside of me. And I knew after that everything was going to be okay, no matter what happened. And so Jacob stayed in St. Louis and stayed clean and sober for the better part of the next 18 months. And then he told us that he wanted to come home to Sykeston because he missed us and he missed his friends. And we said, we had a lot of misgivings, but we told him that he could move back in with us. And I'd like to tell you that he stayed clean and sober, and it was all, you know, roses, but it hasn't been like that. There's been a lot of ups and downs. And last October, Clayton and I went to the Southwest Regional Forum in Dallas, Texas. And we went a couple of days early because I wanted to show him my alma mater in Dallas and visit with some old friends. And the morning that the conference was supposed to start, a lot of times when we're traveling together, we do our prayer and meditation together. And we did our prayer and meditation, and I have set prayers that I always say every morning. And for some reason, when I finished those set prayers, I said, "And God, please watch over the boys while we're gone and protect them and keep them safe from harm." And so we got our stuff packed up, and we drove to where the conference was at. And Friday night, we had just finished the first session, got back to our room, and my phone rang, and it was my younger son. And he said, "Mom, there's been an incident." He said, "Jacob's been shot." And the next thing I knew, the chief of police was on the phone. And he said, "They're taking your son into surgery. We don't really know, you know, the extent of his injuries, but he was involved in a drug deal that went bad." So we had like a 9-hour drive to get back home from Dallas, and we just threw everything in the car, and we drove all night long to get down there. And, you know, I don't know when I've been gripped with such fear. And we had people calling us off and on through the night, you know, "Yes, he's getting out of surgery." And we finally got home, and we got to the hospital, and the guy that shot him had beat him with the gun before he shot him. He gashed his head open. They had staples in his head. His both eyes were black. He was all beat up, but he was sitting up in bed, and he was conscious. And a little while later, the surgeon came in, and he said, "I don't really understand this." He said, "This is the luckiest kid in the world." He said, "The bullet went in his lower abdomen, and it barely missed," I can't remember what they call it, femoral something artery, the big artery that's down there, okay? And he said if it had hit that, he would have bled out before the ambulance got there. He said it glanced off his pelvic bone, which changed the trajectory of the bullet, and somehow it passed through his intestines, his colon, his prostate, everything that was down there, his, you know, all the internal organs that are down there, and lodged in his buttock, where they were very easily able to remove the bullet. And he sustained no permanent injuries. And the surgeon said, "I do a lot of surgery in this area, you know, for people that have cancer." And he said, "I'm not really sure how this happened," because he said those organs have, like, not only are they right next to each other, they have connective tissue. And somehow the bullet just went through everything. And of course, I don't believe in luck. I believe in the hand of God. And Jacob walked away from the hospital 2 days later and was back in school the next week. And 10 days from now, he's going to be graduating from high school and has been accepted to go to Mississippi State University next year. And that is truly a miracle. And I just want to close. I hope I haven't run over too much, but I just want to close. One of the things that I have struggled with a lot in sobriety over the years is the 11th step. And, you know, trying to figure out what God's will is for me. And somebody gave me a prayer. I heard it, you know, early in sobriety, and it's really helped me. And it's written by a man named Thomas Merton. And I just want to read it to you because it really helped me a lot. It says, "Dear God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe this. I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. I hope I have that desire in everything I do. I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it at the time. Therefore, I will trust you always, for though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, I will not be afraid because I know you will never leave me to face my troubles alone. Thank you.